Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I'm the center's deputy director, Marianne Page. In January 2014, the center hosted the War on Poverty Conference. The conference featured top poverty experts from across the country to discuss the U.S. safety net on the 50-year anniversary of the War on Poverty. In this presentation, Greg Duncan discusses Douglas Miller's paper, Long Run Puzzles and Head Start Research. Duncan is an economist and distinguished professor in the Department of Education at the University of California, Irvine. He currently serves as chair of a National Research Council's Institute on Medicine Committee on Child Research.
I want to start with additional legacies. And now the pressure is on to show cute kids somehow. So here you go. That's my attempt. That is Mary Corcoran and me. You don't like that cute kid? How about that cute kid? Okay, moving back here. There was a research legacy, right, to the War on Poverty, and one of the products was the PSID. The PSID really came out of the War on Poverty. The Office of Economic Opportunity ran the Survey of Economic Opportunity in 1966. And then Jim Smith, not the RAND Jim Smith, but one of the other 2.1 million Jim Smiths in the country, came to Jim Morgan at the Survey Research Center and said, look, we have to understand something about poverty dynamics. Why don't you take a subset of the low-income portion of the Survey of Economic Opportunity and follow them for 5 years, right? And Jim said, that's a dumb idea. You know, he was always writing his proposals, responding to calls for proposals and telling the people who issued the calls why they were looking after the wrong question, right? And here's the question you really should. So, but in this case, he said, it's crazy just to start with a sample of low-income families. Let's start with a representative sample, oversample low-income families so that we can get both directions of poverty flows and so forth. So it was set up as a five-year study. In the fifth year, that was the year that Nixon put the OEO out of business unceremoniously, almost overnight. And Larry Orr claims, you never know about these histories, that when the file for the PSID was transferred from OEO into ASPE, it was a five-year study, right? It was the fifth year. Somebody wrote, this is a 10-year study on the file. So there was support for it in ASPE that they assumed it was designed to be a 10-year study, and after 10 years, then NSF started funding it. So, you know, the rest is history, as they say. So let me quickly go past that and talk about, first, this really difficult puzzle. You know, what is it about what happens in between the end of the treatment and the long run that connects those two things, right? And as Doug said, there's some very puzzling evidence about this. And my conclusion is, darned if I know. It's a really, really tough question. And if you try to make sense out of it from the literature, this is an article of Catherine Magnuson and I did last year doing a summary of early child education programs, and we basically said this is a very important challenge and we don't have the answer to it. You know, Heckman has an attempt to do this with the Perry study. It's really pretty inconclusive. It seemed the one substantial finding was that antisocial behavior impacts of Perry seem to account for a substantial amount of the long-run crime outcomes, but none of the other stuff really behaved as you would have hoped it would. There was no kind of overall explanation. Ron Haskins, whom many of you know, was a staff person on the Abecedarian Project in North Carolina. There are many stories that people tell about his behavior back then. But he estimated perverse impacts of Abecedarian on behavior, and yet Abecedarian has these positive outcomes. And then, as Doug said, David Deming has a nice extension of the original Curry and Duncan study of NLSY using fixed effects and showing long-run outcomes, One way of summarizing the long-run outcomes he finds is this kind of aggregated impact. He puts together a lot of achievement-related indicators and comes up with a sibling-based estimate of 0.23 standard deviations, right, for an adult outcome. He's got some intermediate evidence. These are the PIOT test scores. Again, these are sibling fixed effect estimates. So they do persist through at least age 7 to 10, and then they become insignificant, right? That was the fade out that Doug talked about. Males only, they're more persistent. Actually, this idea that these programs only work for females, if you look at a broader set of early childhood education programs, that result just doesn't hold up, right? And it doesn't seem to hold up very well here either. There were, you know, some grade retention impacts, which were bigger for males, some learning disability impacts, which were insignificant for males. And there were no behavior impacts in the paper, and I thought I had seen a draft of the paper where he had some behavior problems. So I emailed him yesterday, and he emailed back the results for the behavior problem index swung somewhat wildly, although if you squinted, you could see something, right? So it's a very spotty record of intermediate impacts. And you know, I think a lot of people are thinking that it's it can't be cognitive because you did have test the fade out in a number of these studies. But sometimes I think it's important to distinguish between IQ measures and achievement measures, right? And I think concrete achievement measures tend to show somewhat less fade out. And they're the ones, I think, that are the intermediate most likely to succeed. If you look into the developmental literature, there's one study that I did with a whole bunch of other people where we took six data sets, the two British cohort studies, NLSY, a bunch of others, all of which, this is just a correlational study, but all of them had school entry measures of reading achievement, math achievement, attention problems, antisocial behavior, where you're expecting a negative impact, mental health problems, where you're expecting a negative impact. These are the kind of things that an early education program might target. And it's useful just to see what the associations are, controlling for family background, controlling in five of the six studies for IQ, controlling for temperament, right? So there are a lot of controls. And I would have expected, and you know, I was on the Neurons and Neighborhoods report committee, and there the message was that the socio-emotional behaviors were every bit as important for school readiness. So I would have expected a lot of action all across this table. But if you look at all the different achievement measures, sometimes test score, sometimes teacher report, on average, maybe in third grade or fourth grade, but ranging from first grade to eighth grade, if you just do standardized coefficients, standardizing the independent variables, standardizing the dependent variables, all the action really is in the achievement scores early on. So kindergarten entry reading is most predictive of later reading and marginally predictive math scores. Math early on is just as predictive, that's surprising, of reading as early reading is, and of course very predictive of later math. So I could talk for a long time about this. If you look at growth over the course of kindergarten, kids who grow the most in math are more successful later on. If you look in early grades at things like high school dropout and college attendance, math again emerges as the most important. But here you get some action with this attention behavior problem, the hyperactivity subscale of the behavior problem index, but really no action for antisocial behavior or these mental health problems. And I think what's going on here, you know, if you look at a life cycle pattern of antisocial behavior, it peaks at 2.5, right? I mean, literally. And the big project for a 2.5-year-old is by the time they get to school to develop the kind of self-regulation, you know, to be able to control these reactions when you've got an emotionally laden kind of situation. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And a lot of the kids who show up with some antisocial behavior problems in kindergarten, most of them aren't going to be lifetime antisocial if you don't do something about it. They just grow out of it within a year or two. Teacher can handle it. So it's very hard to identify in kindergarten who will be the life course persistent antisocial behavior kids. If you can identify them, that's very important because they have terrible trajectories, right? But they're only about 15%, 20% of the initially antisocial kids. So in terms of, you know, what sort of things do you try to develop in an early child education program, I'm going to go with achievement skills first and foremost, because the gap, as Sean's evidence shows, between high and low-income kids in reading and math, 1.2 standard deviations. It's absolutely enormous. It's grown, but that is the gap in kindergarten. That's the gap in fifth grade. It pretty much persists over the course of school. So my money is more on the initial achievement measures. Maybe this, the attention, executive function kind of things to a lesser extent, but I'll get more into that later. So let me switch gears here and ask, how should we think about Head Start? You know, it's important to nail down their long-run impacts, but to what extent, even if you could nail down the long-run impacts, is that relevant today? Doug talked about this, right? Is it a so 20th century program? And I would argue yes, right? I don't love Head Start now. I love other things that I will talk about. One of the projects I've been involved with is to try to identify all the early child education evaluations that were published between 1960 and 2007 and code up what their impacts were, along with a lot of other characteristics, were their random assignment, how big were they, and so forth. And if you take Perry and Abecedarian and array them according to the date that they began, basically, right? You get this really big impact from Perry, big impact from Abecedarian. These are the cognitive impacts where you take all the available either IQ or achievement measures around the end of treatment and just average them. The size of the bubble is proportional to the size of the sample, right? So you want some idea of how much weight you should accord these different studies. So those are the success stories, right? They're the rest. The Head Start studies really were a lot of experimental, quasi-experimental Head Start studies in the 1960s. And then, of course, these are the Curry and Thomas and the National Head Start study. We limited the diameter to equal 1,000 just so that that some of these really big studies wouldn't dominate. But you get an idea of what the big studies and the small studies are. Not always a random assignment, but the average effect size for random assignment is pretty similar to non-random assignments, so that doesn't seem to be accounting for very much. But you tend to get considerably bigger impacts early on, even among the Head Start studies, right? A little bit higher average impact early on. And if you do the weighted regression line, right, the big circles are carrying a lot of the weight here. Instead of thinking of these ECE programs as having impacts of one standard deviation, you should be thinking of the average as more like 0.3 standard deviations, right? Not so big. And what's really worrying is it's declining over time, right? Why aren't we getting smarter about the design of early childhood education programs? But I think a lot of what's going on is the counterfactual. Doug mentioned this a little bit, but if you look at a time series of what fraction of 3- and 4-year-olds are enrolled in some kind of center-based care with some kind of curriculum, you end up with kids from all the points of the income distribution increasing. But the counterfactual, back for Perry and Abecedarian and the early Head Start, or the early Head Start studies, had kids, less than 20% of them, in center-based care. They were at home for the most part. That's grown, and now it's up to over 40%, right? We know from the National Head Start study that 40% or so of the kids In the control group or in center-based care, it varied somewhat by 3- and 4-year-olds. But the counterfactual, the bar has risen a lot on the basis of center-based care. The bar has risen a lot in terms of maternal education, right? If you think of these kids as being at home with their mom, this is PSID data, but kids born in the late 50s, in the bottom quintile of the income distribution, the average level of education of the moms was a little over 8 years, right? That grew a lot, and actually the bottom came closer, caught up a bit with the top quintile. But the kind of environment that the kids are in terms of the home environment, as measured by the maternal levels of education, is presumably much better now than it used to be, right? So the bar for, and then the final thing is family size, right? Where big family size is back in the 60s. So the kids in Abecedarian and Head Start and in the studies that you're have done and are talking about doing, the counterfactual, right? The kids weren't in center-based care. Their moms had low levels of education, and they had a lot of siblings competing for the time and attention of their mom. So it was pretty easy to do a good job against that, and much more difficult now. So why am I soured on Head Start? If you think about the latest best evidence from the National Impact Study, you know, the impacts weren't very big. They were 0.2, 0.3 standard deviation. Relative to that 1.2 standard deviation gap between high and low income kids, that's not going to make much of a dent. That's a pretty extreme comparison, but between the top and bottom and the middle, it's about half that big. So how can we do better? And I would argue that the HEDPAC impact study are pretty discouraging. Pre-K, right, is a totally different funding stream. It comes from states for the most part. And it is set up in a different kind of model. It tends to have higher quality teachers. It tends to use more proven curricula. It tends to pay more attention to whether that curricula is well implemented. There are certainly low-quality implementations of pre-K, and their effects aren't very big. But there are very high-quality implementations of pre-K. And one of the places I've been doing some work is in Boston, which has set up a citywide pre-K system. They've run it for about almost 10 years now. They have designed a curriculum that's based on, you know, IES-proven math curricula, IES-proven literacy curricula. They've tried to integrate behavioral development as part of it. They do professional development. They spend a lot of money. I mean, it's $12,000 per kid. But the teachers get a lot of professional development. There's coaching where the coaches are going in and trying to make sure that this curriculum gets implemented in the right kind of way. And Chris Weiland and Hiro Yoshikawa have done a regression discontinuity study of Boston. And these are the kind of impacts that they estimate. The receptive vocabulary, Wilcock-Johnson letter word, which is kind of early reading skills, the math section of the Wilcock-Johnson, and then here's another math test. So these are pretty respectable effect sizes, right? It's an expensive program. It's implemented in a very high-quality way. Tulsa is another example where it was a high-quality implementation, and the impacts are not quite as big as this, but they're almost as big as this. What Chris and Hiro did, in addition to the conventional kind of academic measures, was to look at various components of executive functioning, things like working memory. Couple measures of there. Pencil tap, if you've got a 4-year-old, I was talking to someone about this. If this is impulse control, right? You tell that child, I'm going to tap my pencil twice, you tap your pencil once. If I tap once, you tap twice, right? So they have to inhibit the impulse to do exactly what you did and do the opposite thing. It's kind of like Simon Says, right? And right around age 4 to 5, that degree of self-regulation, cognitive self-regulation, kind of kicks in. But it's better to do it early, and it's better to do it in the context of school, right? So this is a measure looking at impacts on those. The effect sizes aren't as large, but you know, I think people who advocate for a curriculum exclusively focused on executive functioning and not on achievement, if you can get both at the same time in the context of doing a good achievement kind of intervention and get the executive functioning skills boosted at the same time, then I would always opt for that, right? I think Head Start is set up in a way where this is never going to happen, right? If you look at just, they have done a good job of trying to bring up the very low quality programs. They have a new quality improvement system that I think is going to move the bar up more. But structurally, it's just not set up in the kind of way where it's going to be easy to attain at scale the really high level of quality that we need and that are apparent in at least some of the pre-K programs. So that's kind of my bottom line. So we need to learn what we can from these early impacts, but, and this is overstating, keep in mind their inability to inform current ECE policy. Thanks.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.